Moore versus Bryant, Ms. Osterberger.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. Again, my name is Domenica Osterberger. I'm an assistant Illinois attorney general, and I represent the warden in this cause. The district court granted habeas relief to the petitioner on the ground that petitioner's plea was involuntary because his attorney purportedly gave him wrong advice regarding the applicability of a change in the good time credit statute in Illinois. Respondent has argued several reasons before this court as to why the district court's decision was an error. The primary reason is that there simply is not a factual basis in the state court record to support the district court's conclusion that, in fact, the attorney, whose name was James Kuehl, advised the petitioner in the manner that petitioner complains about. As a factual background to this, in 1995, Illinois changed the method by which good time credit is applied to particular sentences. However, at the time that petitioner committed his offense, which was in December of 1994, the good time credit statute provided that a petitioner should generally receive what's commonly referred to as day-to-day credit.
The lawyer discussed this expected new statute with Moore, the statute hadn't been passed yet.
No, it had not, Your Honor.
Right. But was the text of the statute available?
The attorney's testimony does not indicate whether or not he knew whether or not the text of the statute was available. I can inform the court that the records of the Illinois Senate and the Illinois House indicate that I believe that the Senate's first debate on the proposed statutory change was in March. The House's first debate on the proposed statutory change was in April. And it appears as if they agreed upon the bill on May 24th of 1995, which was after the plea in this case.
Right.
It wasn't signed into law until August.
The bill that was passed fixed August 20th as the cutoff.
My understanding of the bill that was passed was that it was one of the bills that said upon signing it, it's going to become effective. And August 20th, I believe, is the day. August 20th was certainly the day of effectiveness, and I believe that was also the day that it was signed by the governor.
Okay, so now the draft that was available, that would have been available to him, would have said takes effect on signing, you haven't seen it yourself.
No, and as a matter of fact, I don't know, frankly, what changes were made between the House and Senate debates regarding the proposed change. Or whether or not there was a change within from the first reading in the House to the third reading in the House, etc.
Ms. Osterberger, given that Mr. Moore had rejected the plea option until he had the conversation with his attorney in which the erroneous possibility of the much longer time in prison was revealed, how could we say that it didn't affect his plea decision? In other words, isn't the timing alone suspicious here?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I take issue with a basis of your question, which is that, in fact, the attorney did misadvise him in the manner that he argues. And if I may address that briefly, and then I'd like to address the testimony of the petitioner at the motion to withdraw the guilty plea, which I think will answer your question. The petitioner maintained in his motion to withdraw his guilty plea that there were a variety of reasons as to why his plea was involuntary, and he supported that by testimony at the hearing. One of the arguments that he had made was that he was afraid for his safety because that he or his family members had been threatened in some way if he had not pled guilty. The thrust of his argument regarding his attorney's advice was that his attorney's advice left him so depressed and despondent that he had no choice but to plead guilty. Now, in conjunction with that, he alleged in his motion to withdraw the guilty plea that his attorney had misadvised him and told him that he would have to serve 85% of the time if he went to trial. And he alluded to that at his testimony. But the thrust of his argument to the court was not that his plea was based upon his reliance upon this legal advice, but rather that counsel had advised him prior to the trial that, you know, it looks like you probably will be found guilty here. And if you're found guilty here, you're probably going to get a longer sentence than the 20-year minimum that the state is offering you. This is a good deal. This is the best that they're going to give you. So in other words, while he did allege
the lawyer did throw in a monkey wrench by bringing up this 85%. Now, shouldn't the lawyer have gotten hold of the text of the statute? And if he had, he would have seen, I assume, that it would take effect on signing. It wouldn't be retroactive.
I disagree with that. There is no requirement that a lawyer is required to review proposed statutory changes in order to effectively advise their client.
I'm not sure he's required to review them, but if he's going to tell his client about a statute that may affect him, doesn't he have to look at the statute so he knows what it says?
He did not, his testimony, if you read it, Your Honor, to answer your question, is not that I read the statute, petitioner, this is what it says. What the attorney testified to at the motion to withdraw the guilty plea was, you know, Mr. Petitioner, there's going to be a change in the good time credit law. I don't know how it's going to affect you.
But if he looked at the statute, he would have known that it wouldn't affect
him. Right, he doesn't have an obligation. He may not have an obligation to inform Moore that the law is going to change, but he does have an obligation not to misrepresent the law. I mean, in this case, here is what happened. Moore's told he'll spend 10 years if he pleads guilty, but 22 to 27 if he goes to trial and loses. How can something like that not impact someone's decision to believe that he risks 12 to 17 extra years in prison by going to trial rather than the true risk, which is, you know, 2.5 to 5?
Your question is based upon a wrong factual assumption, Your Honor, because the attorney did not testify that he advised Moore that he would have
to serve 85%. Excuse me, you have said to this court today that 85%, okay?
Yes.
Someone with a third grade education could have figured out the amount of years.
If I may complete my answer to your question, Your Honor, petitioner certainly did allege that his attorney advised him that he would have to serve 85% of the law. But the attorney did not say that he advised the petitioner that he would have to serve 85% of his sentence. What the attorney testified to was that there was going to be a change in the law. He didn't know how it was going to affect the petitioner. He didn't know if it was going to be retroactive. He didn't know whether or not petitioner would have to serve 50%, 100%, or 85%. So if you look at the testimony of the attorney, it is not in support of the claim that he affirmatively said to the petitioner, you are going to serve 85%
of this. I think you're kind of splitting hairs. It could have been 100%. That's even worse.
Well, in fact, Your Honor, 85% was not the law that was enacted.
If he'd looked at the statute, he could have avoided all this confusion.
I don't know if it was available to him.
You just said it was available.
It was debated in the Senate and the House. I don't know that
you
had it
before. You didn't answer me very clearly. I asked you whether the text of the statute was available before it was actually enacted. You said yes, I thought.
Well, I thought what you said was that what was available was under debate, but you did that was not available what the ultimate bill was after the debate.
That's right.
In its final form, it was not available, and you didn't see it, and he didn't see or couldn't have.
That's right. I don't know what the proposed change was. I do know what the final answer was, which was that first thing
afterwards,
which was ultimately in late May, and then ultimately came into effect in August. That being, it is the Senate's position.
Well, obviously, debate on the basis of a text of some sort.
Again, it's the respondent's position, however, that the attorney did not acknowledge that he advised petitioner in the way that petitioner claims that he advised him. The other component of our argument is that good time credit is a collateral consequence of the plea.
Well, that doesn't, that is very unconvincing to me. I mean, that's the essence. The essence is how much time you're going to serve. I mean, that's the heart of it. Not whether you're going to lose your right to vote or carry guns or run for office or something like that.
But to the contrary, Your Honor, the time served that the petitioner had to be advised about was the sentence, which was 20 years. The amount of good time credit that was available or could have been revoked, may I complete my thought? The amount of good time credit that was available to petitioner that could have been revoked was subject to revocation. Petitioner was advised that he was to serve a sentence of up to 20 years, that the Department of Corrections could keep him for up to 20 years. And quite frankly, if we start talking about whether or not a plea was voluntary on the basis of anticipated good time credit, then it leads to a slippery slope. If, in fact, the petitioner anticipates that he's only going to serve 10 years and he gets good time credit revoked and ends up serving 12, what's to say that he couldn't come into court and argue that his plea wasn't voluntary in the sense that he only volunteered to serve 10 years out of the 20 of his sentence?
Okay, thank you, Ms. Osterberg.
Thank you.
Mr. Ryan?
Please support counsel. I'm Marty Ryan. I represent habeas petitioner Greg Moore. I'd like to respond to the state's assertion here that there's no factual basis that, actually, I happen to know the guy is pronounced Keel, even though it's spelled like Keel. You gave him this incorrect advice. If we actually look at the testimony, after we talk about the percentages, you know, Moore says he took the plea. Jim Keel told me if I took the plea, I don't have to do 50% or 10 out of 20 years. But if not, and I went to trial and I got convicted, you'd have to serve maybe 85% out of 25 to 30 years, which comes out to 22 to 27 actual years, you know, basically more than double the time actually spent in jail. And in his testimony, Moore said he didn't want to plead guilty, but, quote, he had an urge to do it because Jim Keel said it was in my best interest, unquote. Also, he said he pleaded guilty because, quote, that's what my lawyer said I had to do, unquote. Jim Keel did not say, Greg, I think you should plead guilty because you're depressed. He said, you know, I think, Greg, you've got a fair chance at acquittal, but I think it's more likely that if you go to trial, you're going to get convicted. It's not a slam dunk for the state, but you're probably going to get convicted. I'm worried that this new law could apply to you.
Is there any, Mr. Ryan, is there any testimony in the record establishing that the misinformation, Moore would not have pled guilty?
I think so, because he says, specifically, I pleaded guilty. I think if you connect the testimony of the two, of Greg Moore and Jim Keel, and the testimony, it meshes together. Jim Keel was concerned that if his client didn't take this deal, he was going to have to do a heck of a lot more time in prison. He didn't, you know, if he goes to trial. Greg says, I ultimately did this because that's what my lawyer said I had to do. And I think between those two statements, unrebutted by anything else, establishes the basis that that's why Greg Moore pleaded guilty. Because again, this other stuff that's in there about him being depressed or not getting enough food when he's in the juvenile detention center doesn't play any role in Keel's advice to him. Keel doesn't give that any credence as to, yeah, you should plead guilty to get out of there. You should plead guilty because you're depressed. He doesn't say that. He says, I'm worried, I'm concerned that this could apply to you. And under the case law, even if the Illinois legislature had tried to apply it retroactively, it couldn't have, constitutionally. The Illinois Supreme Court had already ruled in a much less drastic case, which only involved a very, very small, like, decrease in time served for a limited class of prisoners who were doing educational programs. A case I've cited over and over, Barger versus Peters, which was available the entire time of this case. You know, would have precluded the legislature from even being able to try it retroactively. The fact is, when Mr. Keel said it wasn't clear whether it legally could be retroactive, he was incorrect at that time, because it could not have been. Not legally. And, you know, again, I think, as you pointed out, Your Honor, the result of the error is to dramatically increase the gauged risk of going to trial. You're looking at doing 22 to 27 and convicted instead of the actual price, which is more like 12 and a half to 15, which is a much more reasonable gamble, especially when your lawyer tells you there is a fair shot you could get acquitted, even if it's more likely you can get convicted. Um,
How much time has he served? Since 97, is it?
Yes. Actually, he's been in custody since January of 95. He has done about 9 years out of the 10 years he'd have to do. He's, my understanding is he's due for release under his current sentence next October. If there are no further questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Berger. We'll now take a brief recess before hearing our last.